everyone. Welcome to the first ever episode of The Gallery. I'm your host, Claudia Osorio. We're a Houston-based podcast featuring local artists, and our focus is to interview a vast array of talented individuals, from musicians to dancers to writers and comedians. I feel each artist is a brilliant representative of their craft, and I'm really excited to spotlight various art forms that are, like our city, exceptionally diverse. What I hope to achieve with this podcast series is for you, the listener and fellow art lover, just to go out and catch a show, discover local music, visit an art gallery, buy local art, attend an improv showcase, listen to local podcasts, and just support our scene. In the meantime, I hope you'll follow along as I interview some of Houston's vibrant talent and explore what is currently inspiring their craft. Today's guest is a very good friend of mine. Her name is Valeria Pinchuk. She's a female artist based here in Houston. Some of you might recognize her from her local band, Birthday Club, but you might have also seen some of her artwork on some show posters around town. Her prints are so gorgeous and the colors just so beautiful, so vibrant. And I'm really, really grateful to have her on the show today. So welcome to the show, Valerie. She was born in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic in 1987. You moved to Texas in 1993, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you got your degree in Slavic Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. What made you decide on that?
Well, when I moved to the U.S., I only knew how to speak Russian, but by the time that I reached my 20s, I had forgotten most of it, and I decided that since I wanted to relearn Russian, I might as well get a degree out of it, too. So that's what I ended up doing. The other stuff I got, just so that it was a little more practical, and if I ever wanted to get a job, then I would make it easier. It's interesting to me, too.
Yeah.
Just that part of the world is really weird. And it's always been interesting to me that I'm from a country that no longer exists. Like, you can go back to that place, but it isn't anything like what it was when it was a Soviet state. So I decided that I wanted to study that so I had a better understanding of it.
You are a woman of many accomplishments. You're a Renaissance woman. So throughout your career as a freelance artist, you designed chalkboard menus for cafes, shirts for bands, concert posters, illustrations for Free Press magazine. Is that right?
That's right.
An art installation for Free Press Summer Festival as well. When you're not drawing, you also play synth for the local band Birthday Club. And your artist name is Beloved. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I was recently at a live drawing at Tomo Mags, which was actually pretty cool. I had never been to anything like that. How did you get involved in doing a live drawing?
Well, first I'd like to clarify, because I was asked about this recently, the difference between a live drawing session and a life drawing session.
Okay.
Life drawing sessions are typically when a model comes and they pose, sometimes with clothes on, sometimes not. And people draw them. That's a life drawing session. That's not what I did. I did a live drawing session, which means I just hung out at a place and drew things, and people got to watch me, and people got to buy my work as I was doing it.
Yeah, people were coming up and requesting some stuff, and I was one of them. Yeah. I requested a portrait of my cat, a live
yes.
drawing.
Yes, and yeah. And that was great because I love drawing cats. But the way I got involved with that was there's this local magazine store and art gallery called Tomo Mags. It's off of Hawthorne Street in the Montrose, and they were just really interested in hosting a type of event that would get more members of the community in. They asked Blake Jones, another local artist, if he could host the event and get a couple more people involved, and I was fortunate enough to be invited by him. So that was something that I'd never really done before, but it was super fun.
And the space was really cool, too.
Yeah, and I'm just waiting for them to call me back to do it again.
You recently moved back to Houston. Well, I would say recently, but you'd been away for a while. You lived in Austin. And
actually, I I recently moved back to Houston from Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I was living up in Pittsburgh for 5 years for school, and I made the decision to move back to Houston about 2 years ago. I was just actually pretty desperate to get back. It all really boiled down to the economy. Honestly, I wasn't affected by the shitty Pittsburgh economy, but obviously everybody around me was, and the climate was just really discouraging for an artist in a lot of ways, simply because there just were very few practical reasons to make anything up there. Of course, you know, as a suffering artist, I made plenty of work, but ultimately it wasn't a sustainable environment for me. And all my friends kept asking when I was going to move back, so I just went ahead and did it.
Where did I get Austin from? Because I remember talking to Steven. So you...
Steven was living in Austin.
Okay, because... Okay, so Steven is your other half. Is that safe to say?
Yes. He's your other half. He is my love partner.
Your kindred spirit, I feel like. So Steven and I actually go way back, back in his days on as part of the Featherface band. And I actually met you, this is actually pretty cool now that I'm thinking about it, because I met you a year ago on my birthday.
Yep.
You showed up. I spoke to Steven and he said, hey, like, do you mind if we swing by? Because I think he posted something or I posted something about my birthday. Mm-hmm. I think he might've just been like, happy birthday. And, I said, hey, if you want to come hang, we're going to be hanging out at this place tonight. And he said, yeah, we'll swing by. And so when he said wheel,
we were just fused at that point. I met that guy, around, I guess, Christmas of 2015, maybe. Yeah. I think 2015.
Christmas of 2015?
No. Okay. Christmas of 2014.
Yeah, that was, we met and, on my birthday last year, October 2015.
He moved back to Houston just a few weeks after we met, and we've basically been inseparable ever since. We just, we started hanging out, and we never stopped.
Right. You joined his band. This was his idea to start Birthday Club, and you wanted to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you've played music before.
Apart
from doing art and stuff. So how did you get started? Because you also play the accordion, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's really weird how that happened. The first instrument I ever played was piano. My mom is a piano teacher, and growing up in her house, piano was always the punishment, and I just happened to learn everything that I learned about the piano by getting grounded, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And formally, the first band I ever played with was Space City Gamelon in Houston, which is a very different type of music. Their scales aren't even the same as the stuff that we're used to, and I encourage everybody to look up Gamelon music on YouTube and have your minds blown. It's really weird. It's just a bunch of gongs and chimes and stuff. That was the first band I played in. And then I had a roommate that happened to have two accordions. And as a joke, one day I suggested that we go to the park and play some fat accordion licks. And he started teaching me a song, and he and I were both really taken aback at how quickly I caught on to it. And maybe because of the piano background, maybe because I'm Ukrainian and it's just ingrained into generations of my people. I don't know. But that was the first instrument that I realized I really was meant to sort of play as soon as I picked it up. And I did that with quite a few different bands over the years. I'm taking a break right now just because I'd say maybe 5 to 10 years ago, a lot more indie bands wanted accordion, but right now it's kind of like out of fashion. So there's nobody that's a shredder for me to play with, and it's no fun playing by yourself.
If you had to choose one art form to express yourself through, for the rest of your life, would it be music or would it be your drawing?
No, it would definitely be drawing. Okay. There's no competition.
Oh, okay.
When I make art, like visual art, I forget who I am. It's really strange. There's just this thing I've always really liked about drawing, and that is that it's really rare that you get the opportunity to see yourself objectively. Like, everything that you do is just sort of tainted by yourself in a lot of ways. And for some reason, for me, anytime I draw stuff and then I look at that thing, it just looks like a thing outside of myself. And I always, especially when I make something that, you know, I think is really cool, I'll just sit for a while and kind of wonder how the hell did that thing come out of me? It's so strange. When I play music, it's very much an ego thing where it's almost as if I'm trying to prove to myself that I can do it. And it's actually, unfortunately, really rare, like the times that I can forget and just sort of let the art happen through me. But visual art has, ever since I was a kid, it's always been that.
No, that's really interesting because I've always felt like visual art was just like the coolest. Because you're essentially putting something down either on canvas or on paper, mm-hmm. and you get to keep that. So if you do something that's just supremely well done, it's there forever. And whereas if you go out and you play a good show, I mean, unless somebody was recording it, of course.
Yeah.
But like, that's it. Your next show could not be that great.
Yeah. And that is interesting. And that's something I talk about a lot with my band. Anytime, you know, we played an unenthusiastic room or whatever, I'll always say, listen, if people aren't reacting to what you're doing right now, it doesn't even necessarily mean that you did a bad job. They could just be having a bad day. They're not mindful of their surroundings. They're not actually hearing what's happening. You never know. But I do see art as more of an equalizer where anybody can take a moment and develop an opinion about something, and that might be formed by the kind of day that they're having, but they're not going to be so distracted with something else that they just mistake it for something else.
Right. Yeah.
And I feel like hearing-wise, people do tune a lot out or interpret it differently. I'm not sure why that is, but yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about.
But if you did, okay, so I think of it this way. Okay, so as a writer myself, if I wanted to write in any form, like, would I accept a job at Hallmark and just write cards for the rest of my life just so that I can get to write? Like, what would be the equivalent for that, I feel like, for somebody who draws, like, making doormats that have, like, really cute designs? Like, would you do that? Like, I mean, if that was, like, the last thing and that's the only way that you could draw is, like, here, Valerie, like you can only design doormats, do that. Like, I feel like if somebody approached me and asked me, the only writing that you will ever do will be for Hallmark, and you're going to write really sad cards for people that are going through bereavement. And I would be like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to do it because I love writing so much.
Well, that sounds like kind of tight, but
yeah. You want to make doormats?
Well, one of the artists that one of my favorite visual artists is actually a cartoonist named Robert Crumb. Mm. And I mean, I remember the first time a friend of mine, my friend Ashlyn Davis, who's actually the director of the Houston Center of Photography now in Houston, She was living out in New York for a while and working for Penguin Books, and she sent me a care package once that had this insert of just, it was like a low-quality printout zine of one of the comics that R. Crumb did, and that was my first exposure to him. And I remember looking at the drawing that he made and just going, holy fuck. Like, I thought that I was the only person that had this kind of worldview, and there is somebody out there that's like me. And Robert Crumb actually got started drawing for a greeting card company. That was his first professional artistic job, and he did it for a long time, and he was totally miserable. And I think it was in the 60s and 70s that he really started gaining traction as this super subversive, like pseudo psychedelic artist. And I feel like if he wasn't working for the greeting card company, none of that would have happened, because he was rebelling against his misery while just working at the paper mill. And, you know, I do believe that so long as I have a reason to keep drawing, it doesn't matter what those drawings are, it's going to get me somewhere, because this is an activity that has always made me feel like my reality was sort of heightened in a lot of ways. And yeah, I mean, right now it's very rare that I draw for myself. I just don't have the amount of free time for that with the band, and I also have a job. But what keeps me drawing is people need flyers for things, or people need graphics for things, and my friends will get in touch with me and ask me to make it. And every time, even if it's something that I never would have drawn for myself, I learn something new about myself by making it. And I really enjoy that, because it's guaranteed every time. It's, you can go on a walk and sometimes you might have an epiphany and sometimes you won't, but every time I make art, it's guaranteed for me. And it's kind of ironic that I haven't figured out how to keep doing this for myself yet, where I just make
myself
do it.
You've got to make some doormats. Right? I'm telling you, that's the business to get into. I keep getting these emails. The reason I keep bringing it up is because I keep getting these happy fall, y'all. Ugh. Doormat emails from like Joss & Main and Kirkland's and all sorts of stores. And I was like, I'm going to be ironic and buy one of those. But then I realized if I go ahead and buy one, it'll probably go missing, because the lady across the street will probably steal it from my front porch. Just like she stole an edible arrangement from me. It was actually delivered to her house. It was for me, but she took it. And so I'm like, if she was capable of doing that, she is capable of taking my happy fall, y'all.
That lady's capable of anything.
Anything. Which is why I don't let my cats roam free outside. they never have. All my cats have been indoor cats, and I know that might not be the best thing for them.
Oh, sorry, guys. I just had a pop the rosé.
We stopped by and we bought a bottle of Notorious Pink.
Well, there is a very special occasion that we're celebrating.
What, my birthday?
This rosé is for Claudia's birthday.
Yeah. I'm 27 years young, as the old man in the bookstore told me. He said, you're 27 years young.
How old was he?
He is 83. I used to work with him.
Oh, that's a good joke.
Yeah.
If you're an old person.
Yeah, he'd always tell me, he's like, you know, until you get to like 40, it's always going to be like, I'm so and so years young. Because he was like, it's not till you get to my age that you can start saying like, oh, I'm 83 today. Today I'm 83 years old.
I think that if you ever want somebody to design a doormat for you, I could make you an It's Fall, Y'all doormat with just a really sassy cat that's like, holding a coffee mug.
Or like a Texas, the outline of Texas.
Wait,
with like,
it says It's Fall, Y'all around the cat, and then he's holding a coffee mug, and the coffee mug also says It's Fall, Y'all.
Yeah. I feel like there should be like the outline of the state of Texas.
It'll be Texas shape.
It'll be okay. I saw a pillow that was Texas shaped, and it had like, it was a Christmas pillow, and it had like the panhandle had the little like Santa hat on it. Mm. And I was like, this is going to be my house. This is like primary decor that I'm going for. Like Southern rustic chic, or something.
Well, you're in good company. There's lots of people in Texas that can accommodate that decor decision.
But I want you to design it, like everything.
I'll design anything. Yeah. I'll design anything for anybody. This one time when I was illustrating for Free Press, I was illustrating Marini Van Smeeren's column, Bad Vice. And this wasn't even for the column, but she really wanted just a scenic, rustic autumn scene over a little stream. And there's a reflection. She wanted it to be very pleasant. But for some reason she wanted a dick bridge. She wanted the bridge over the stream to just be a penis. And it's like,
That sounds
I'm pretty nice. Sure that I sort of I wept. The tears were streaming down my face as I drew it because I just felt so demoralized. But I still just couldn't resist because I'd never drawn that before.
And just like,
and I wanted to see if I could do it. And I feel like I did a pretty all right job. It might be in the archives. I don't know.
We might have to dig that one up. I'd like to showcase that one as a part of your collection. I feel like that should be a part of a post.
Yeah, we should definitely feature it in the gallery.
And just put like not safe for work. Hashtag not safe for work.
Right.
Hashtag blessed.
There will be a bridge photoshopped over the dick, and then you have to click on it to see the original.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I want to talk a little bit more about your love for cats, because you have a very special cat. And I bring him up because he is unlike any cat. And I feel, okay, people that are listening to this are going to be like, oh my God, that's what like every cat owner says. Like, my cat is the most unique cat in the world. Like, he's the ultimate grand supreme cat of all cats.
Mm-hmm.
However, yours in particular is very interesting because you guys do a thing with him called the pizza toss. And you just kind of like stretch him out like pizza dough.
Yeah, well, that's mostly Steven's thing. I don't do the pizza toss.
You egg it on.
Well, mostly it's just I lack the upper body strength to do the pizza toss with him. But I would say that he's pretty tolerant of the pizza toss. You can do the pizza toss with any cat. It's just what happens when the pizza lands is going to go very differently for every cat situation. Oh,
I can tell you what happens when the recipient of the pizza toss is somebody who's just not willing.
What happens?
Well, Pinocchi, my cat, he is what the vet calls morbidly obese. And he's 22 pounds. And that for a cat is apparently morbidly obese. Like, apparently for every 2 pounds, it's like 20 pounds overweight for a human being. So after a night of you and I having a dinner and lots of wine and doing pizza toss with Ghostface, your cat, which is your cat's name, I was like, I'm going to go home and try this with Pinocchi. Pinocchi is my cat, his name is not Pinocchi, for the record. His real name is Remy, but I didn't choose Remy. My brother did. He chose Remy because he had just watched Ratatouille. And the protagonist's name is Remy, voiced by Patton Oswalt. I'll just throw that in there because it's a really good character. Like, that movie makes me cry. But I was like, you can't name a cat after a rat. So then I started calling him all sorts of different names. And Pinocchi was just the one that just stuck to him. So I went home after we hung out and I tried doing the pizza toss with Pinocchi. And I have about like 7 scars on my arm.
Oh no.
And just
Well, you have to clip the nails of any cat before you attempt the pizza toss.
Those weren't claw marks, they were like his teeth.
Oh
like,
no.
He ripped into flesh. He tasted blood and then like could not get enough.
Oh no.
And then he
I'm so sorry.
Like he got a taste of blood and then he had shark eyes and his eyes went black.
Oh.
And then he couldn't get enough because then I couldn't get away. And then he knows how to open doors, which is a problem now because then I will never be safe. So I held him up and I did what you showed me. The position of power. So I held him high up.
Yeah, you have to stretch him and you put your hands just under each part of the cat where his legs hang down, just so that he feels very stretched out, and you hold him as high as you can hold him.
Right. Which was not very, at the top. My strength in my arms, I don't have enough strength.
Well, that's a lot of cat to hold up.
Plus, it's like a morbidly obese cat, according to the veterinarian. I don't think that, and I don't say that to him ever. But yeah, I try to hold him up in his power position. And then I started. I stretched him, and then I started. And then that's when the horror began.
Mm. Well, those that have cats like Pinocchi might want to start out instead of doing the standard pizza toss by just launching the cat onto a soft surface like the bed, you launch the cat away from you, mm-hmm. and then it lands, and when it lands, it shows you whether or not it's digging it. And honestly, I really wouldn't recommend any sort of tossing around of your animals unless your animals are relatively young, because they do have joint problems.
Like, any of them, like, ever enjoy it? You're like, you'll see if he's digging it. I don't think any cat
Well, now we can get back to the point, which is Ghostface is not like a lot of animals.
Right. So that's
because he does enjoy it, and he asks for it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, so he did the pizza and I was like, oh my God, this cat's never going to come out again for the rest of his life after what I just witnessed mm-hmm. and caught on my iPhone. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm so glad I caught that on camera, because I probably will never see it again. And as soon as you put him down, he ran right back into Steven's arms and wanted it all over again. He wanted Steven to give it to him again.
Yeah, my personal theory is he just likes the attention. I got him when he was really, really, really small. I was actually riding my bike to Free Press Summerfest, and on the way there, I found this tiny little puddle of a kitten in the middle of the road.
Mm.
And I kind of looked around. I didn't see mom cat anywhere nearby, and there were cars driving around, which terrified him, and he just peed all over himself because he was scared laying there. I just scooped him and took him home with me, and I feel like he just got integrated into humanity really, really super early, and that might be why he lets you do that kind of stuff to him. I think that the pro of attention outweighs the con of not actually liking to be pizza tossed. And that's what keeps him coming back for more.
Do you ever incorporate Ghost in any of your art? Like, do you ever draw any inspiration from him?
I don't think I've ever actually tried to draw him.
Oh my God. I mean, I'm like, I'm always thinking of Pinocchio. Like, Pinocchio takes up like my thoughts, like, every second of every day.
Ghost definitely inspires me, because I've never really had a problem connecting to, you know, this world or the creatures in it. But there is something really special about, I mean, Ghost really is my best friend. He's the type of creature that when you look him in the eyes, he's actually looking back at you every time. And there are humans that I meet that don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have conversations every day. And I'm not talking superficial meow meow cutesy bullshit. I say things to him and he gets it. And he'll respond. He understands. He might not decide to do the thing I'm asking him to do, but I can always see his brain sort of calculating it, and that is amazing to me, and I think about that a lot, and that does inspire me to think about just the fact that there are tons of creatures on this planet that aren't humans that, you know, are sentient, and we share the world with them, and it's really important to keep that in mind and be mindful about our role as, you know, these creatures that have thumbs and that have all the power.
Well, if I had the opportunity to draw and I had an ounce of talent that you have, I would probably be drawing Pinocchio in like different poses.
Well, yeah, I send me some photos of Pinocchio and I'll draw you all the Pinocchio you want. I
need to commission like a 16-month calendar. because I have some like ideas of like poses, and like I'd like for him to be like a pumpkin, like his body to be a pumpkin since he's orange. I have all these ideas. It's okay. We'll talk about it. We'll talk okay. about it after
we,
the show.
We can talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
We can work something out.
This calendar is for me only. So calm down, everybody that's listening. This is not for public. This is not for the public. This is for Claudia's eyes only.
I feel like the public deserves to know though.
We could maybe do like a public, like Pinocchio. I just don't.
That know. Could be like your greeting card. You could pick one month.
And oh, trust send me. It out. We've, We've taken some shots together. and then I got engaged. And then I was like, I should probably incorporate my fiance and also the rest of my family into my Christmas photos. But for right now, it's just me and Pinoche, and that's okay. I think people understand that relationship. So let's loop back around to growing up and finding your culture and how you incorporate that or how it influenced you growing up, because I feel the way that we actually really connected is we had very interesting cultures that we grew up with. I mean, I'm Hispanic, so I grew up Americanized, but my home life was very different from most of my friends.
So where's your family from?
My mom was born here, but she's Mexican-American. My dad is from El Salvador.
Okay.
He moved here when he was 17 years old. He came here to Houston, and he traveled for a bit. But I feel like that's really like influenced my outlook in life. And I'm not an artist, but I feel like if I were to create art, like I'm not going to go out and be like Frida Kahlo, but like I feel like my culture would, you know, influence a great deal of what I would make visually. So has that actually influenced you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a first generation Ukrainian, and that means I moved to Houston when I was 6 years old, and the way that we got here was my dad actually stowed away on a train and went through a bunch of passport checkpoints in Europe back in the very early 90s, and then he ended up stowing away on a boat and going through hell in order to get my family here. And one of the consequences of that has always been just intense pressure for my entire family to not be an artist, because being an artist or being a musician is seen as a very impractical and unsafe career choice. And so in that regard, it has really very strongly shaped the trajectory that I took. Art and music was always something that was just a fun hobby that would I set on the side. And, you know, I'm about to turn 30, and it was only maybe in the past 5 years that I started considering that I could actually make a comfortable living doing the things that I was passionate about. The other way that just being a person from a different country has always affected me has been the influence of Ukrainian folk art. It's very geometric and it uses a lot of patterns. And I just grew up. The cool thing about the Soviet Union was that artists got tons of government grants to make children's books all the time. And the poems would be pretty hokey and about like being a perfect Soviet citizen or whatever. But the art, just some amazing artists would be featured in these books. And the really sad thing is that it's impossible to track any of them down. It's just a totally lost culture in a lot of ways. But I would just spend, you know, accumulated days of my child life poring over these books that just had all of this detail, and they were so beautiful with these illustrations. And that's just ingrained in me. And whenever I make art, I use tons of patterns and cross-hatching and stuff. And that's all just a direct import sort of from the part of the world that I'm from. I'd also say, too, that one of the reasons all children draw, like everybody draws when they're young. And one of the driving reasons for me drawing as a child was you didn't really get to see a lot of cartoons and stuff on TV in the Soviet Union.
I was just about to ask you that.
Yeah.
Like, how was your growing up? Like, were there any cartoons? Were there any like stories, like kids'
there
tales?
There were, as far as I can remember, and it's surprising that I remember as much as I do, there were about like 6 channels of TV in Soviet Ukraine at the time. none of them were dedicated to children. So there were 2 hours right around 7 p.m. that would feature children's programming, and that was the go-to-sleep children's programming that you got. And then you got to go to sleep. And my parents, they had a great sense of humor, so their thing was watch your go-to-sleep cartoons and then go to sleep, and if you don't, then the KGB is going to come, and they're going to kidnap you and torture you. And I'd be like, God. What's torture?
But, so this isn't like, baby Einstein, like playing like Beethoven.
There was
like,
none of that.
Which I watch actually from time to time to be able to go to sleep.
I would definitely say that it was very similar to children's programming on PBS, circa the 1990s. Okay. But that's all you really got. And animation was pretty rare. And you typically, if you saw a cartoon, then you knew that cartoon by heart.
So was it live action? Like kids program? Like big comfy couch?
Kind of, yeah, a lot like that, where it's like a guy wearing his Soviet Ukrainian embroidered shirt with a flute, and he's telling you poems about birds or something, and then it's time to go to sleep. But in Soviet kindergarten,
go to sleep.
When the kids were being extra good, they would pull out these reels of film, and they would get the projector out, and they would show you the cartoons that you had already seen hundreds of times, but it didn't matter because cartoons were special. And then, of course, like, this is the thing that's most interesting about it to me now as just a fully integrated American. Then there were the bootleg tapes. Everybody knew who Disney was. Everybody knew who Tinkerbell was. Everybody idolized Mickey Mouse. If you went to the beach out there, you would find these just homemade statues of Mickey Mouse.
Oh, I thought you were going to say beach towels. I was like, yeah, I had a Mickey Mouse beach towel. No, because
you had to have machinery to do that. And, that would land you in the gulag or something if you stole that. There was no private enterprise, but people would just erect these artistic sort of like idols to the Western world. And people would take pictures with them. So one of the reasons that I started drawing was because every bootleg video that got passed around between families that came from the U.S. typically started with Tinkerbell lighting the top of the castle. And so I just loved sort of, what's the right word? Summoning. I loved summoning Tinkerbell by just drawing her. And all the kids in my class, they felt like it was enough of a likeness for it to be a hot commodity. And so there were constantly kids asking me to draw Tinkerbell for them. And this was what got me started as an artist back when I was 6 years old. And then
was it like a true likeness, or like when people drew or made these monuments to the Disney characters? Was it, because I mean, I'll tell you, like in El Salvador, you go over there, you're trying to find Hello Kitty, like her face is like the wrong shape. It's like a vertical oval, and like her eyes are just like too tiny, and like her whiskers are enormous, but you know it's Hello Kitty.
Going to send you a scan of a photo you're welcome to use it for your podcast image or whatever. It's me at the beach. Soviet Ukrainian beach. I'm 4 or 5 years old and I'm standing to Mickey Mouse. I mean, he's unmistakable. There's only one mouse out there that looks anything like him, but instead of just those totally non-threatening circular features, he's got kind of pointed ears.
Just like a teens, like Mickey Mouse's like evil doppelganger. Well,
yeah, this is before the internet. It's like someone saw it once and then they're just running with their memory of it.
It's like telephone. Like,
yeah,
it just gets watered down each time.
So in that way, I'm sure my Tinkerbell's blonde hair, a bun on top of the head, green tutu like dress,
but no bangs or something.
Who knows? I don't know. I can't remember right now if she had bangs or not.
Yeah, she probably, like, her skirt was probably a little bit shorter or something. I mean, it's short enough, but I could see you trying to get away with making it just a little bit shorter.
Well, I don't know. I probably did whatever I felt like, because yeah. That's what you do when you're a kid.
Rebel with a cause. So growing up, you came over here. How old were you when you came over to the States?
I came to the States when I was 6 years old, and that was back in 93.
What was that like? What was that? Was it, were you old enough? Because I'm trying to think back, and I'm like, I remember a lot of stuff from when I was 6 years old, but
yeah, I remember a lot too.
But I don't know how that would have affected me, like a different culture. I mean, I've never left Houston. We traveled a lot, but
it really sucked. Honestly, I went from a place that was really beautiful and had a lot of history and was also a utopian society. It wasn't a successful utopia, but just the entire reason for things being that way was officially that it was good for people. Right. And so I went from a place where every single person that we passed on the street in our neighborhood either knew who I was as a, you know, before 6 year old child, or wanted to know who I was and had a vested interest in what kind of a person I would grow up to be. I went from that to living off of like 45 and like Gulf Road and just
the scenic,
concrete
scenic
suburban just wasteland. It was terrible. It was very harsh, the transition. I didn't know the language at all. And what made it harder too was
like, you didn't know
any? No, I didn't know. I didn't know any English. My mom didn't know any English. Oh, and, we came, my dad had gotten there, a year or two before we did. And the thing that made it even worse was Ukraine is half Russian speaking and half Ukrainian speaking. They are very similar languages, but they are their own languages. And we had always spoken Russian in our family. And when he got involved with the legal system in the U.S., he was caught as a stowaway when he decided to swim to shore in Galveston from the oil rig that he was on, because he just couldn't take it anymore being a stowaway on that ship. He was thrown in the immigrant jail. He wasn't given legal counsel, and he wasn't given the option to contact anybody. So he had to smuggle out some letters to the UN and go on a hunger strike to get out of that situation. And the Ukrainian community in Houston, who are very, very nationalistic, they only speak Ukrainian, they hate Russian influence, they helped him out a lot. And so what happened was, when my mom and I moved to the U.S., I didn't know English. Ukrainian was something that I was familiar with, but I hadn't practically ever used it before. And all of a sudden, we're living in an area where everybody was constantly speaking Ukrainian and getting very offended if I spoke the language that I knew. And it was definitely a tough thing to go through. And actually, it stuck with me for most of my life. Anytime I felt like I didn't really understand or relate to the people around me, I just assumed that it was because I was from a different country. But a few years ago, I went back there for the first time, and I had an even harder time relating to the people there. And apparently, this is something that a lot of, typically it's second generation immigrants, not the people that left, but the people that come after them,
like
experience.
Yeah,
where it's, you don't really feel like you belong to either society, and you feel really alienated and weird about it. That's definitely where I still am. I'm still looking for my tribe and my people.
Yeah. I encountered something pretty, my dad has a lot of Salvadoran pride. Mm-hmm. And when we would go back and visit, you know, he'd always be like, this is your land. This is where you come from. And I'm like half Mexican, calm down. So he's mixed as well. And, You know, I mean, he's got a lot of love because he came to the United States at a, he was a little older. So, but yeah, I can definitely relate to that and not being able to feel like you fit in 100% anywhere. And I mean, this is my home and yeah. I'm an American.
So yeah, one of the things that, is super weird about being a Ukrainian is gender identities are very polarized there. So, you know, I wear glasses. I don't wear high heels usually ever, unless I have a really good reason to. Every time I go over there, people actually do this little sigh and they give me this look. And I realize that the look means, oh, no man's ever going to want you looking like that.
Oh, like they feel sorry for you? I thought yeah. they were like exasperated. They're yeah, like, here comes another bohemian.
No, no, oh. there are no bohemians over there. So actually, I remember there was this, I had a really stressful trip to Ukraine once. I was traveling with my dad and I lost a connecting boarding pass on my first flight. And then I had literally an hour and a half to get another one. And it was Christmas and the lines were super long. And the only reason I made my next flight was because it got delayed. And I remember when I finally got to the relative's apartment that I was going to stay that night and I was shown to the room that I would sleep in, I just started crying because I had been holding all the stress of that. And just I was a there was a good chance that I would have gotten stranded in Paris for Christmas with less than $200 in my bank account. I was crying. And then this totally well-meaning woman, she quietly, you know, tapped on the door. And she walks in and she gently starts petting my head. And she goes, oh, honey, don't worry. It's going to be okay. This is all in Russian. Don't worry, it's going to be fine. You'll find a husband someday. And in that moment, what? I just started crying harder because why I was like, no, I'm stranded in this fucking place. Oh my God, this is insane.
You're like, God.
And that attitude, it really applies to most of my family too. It can be really challenging because you can really see that it's hard for them to even see me as a real person just because I happen to have women parts, and women are expected to do very specific things, which aren't be smart or make art. You know, the perfect woman is a type of woman that finds the right kind of man and produces the right kinds of kids. And that's about it. I mean, of course, there are going to be exceptions to that. I don't want to speak for the entire culture, but that currently is the prevailing culture over there. And that makes it even harder to identify with, you know, the country that I'm apparently from, which doesn't exist anymore.
Let's bring it back to Houston.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's super rad. You're not only a female artist, you're a foreign female artist. Because I would consider you foreign. How do you feel you're treated in this scene? You've just told me how they look at females in general in your homeland. But well, here, yeah. what's the scene like for you here as a foreign female artist?
Well, when it comes to visual art, it's actually not so bad. Like, I haven't really come across a whole lot of weirdness. And I think that part of that has to do with the fact that you don't really have to be super social. You don't have to do a ton of networking. Aside from the live drawing event that we talked about earlier, it's very rare that, you know, I am active as an artist around other people. It's a private thing, you know, people get to see the final result, and there's very little that they can really say about that that's gonna really boil it down to just gender, I suppose, unless they're being crucially honest with me, which most people aren't going to be. As a musician, man, it's still kind of the Wild West in a lot of ways. It's, I have had bandmates tell me when I've had, you know, we're at a bar and we're about to play a show and patrons there start making unsolicited sexual comments to me, and I complain about it to my all male bandmates, and they say things like, oh, well, maybe you shouldn't have dressed that way. And they don't even realize
maybe
that
you shouldn't be such a tease. I don't know. Right. Like, don't look at him. Don't make eye contact.
Or asking bartenders about if the band has any drink specials for the night. I've been asked, are you actually in the band? And it's like, would you be asking me this if I were a guy? Or do you think that I'm dating someone that's in the band and I'm trying to take advantage? It's all just preconceptions. And I try to not get all aggro about it when that kind of stuff happens, because I do believe that it's just a matter of education. People just aren't aware of the fact that that's not really acceptable anymore. And I try my best, but yeah, as a visual artist, it isn't really a thing, but just being a woman in this world, you do come across a lot of bullshit. You get mansplained to a lot.
Yeah.
You get ignored because you're not an open hole. You're not single. So people treat you like a non-person because you belong to somebody else and they don't acknowledge your existence, no matter how many times they see you. All sorts of stuff happens. That definitely affects my artwork. And lately I've been going through this phase of doing a lot of, like, I guess I would call it bondage artwork, where I draw really vulnerable women.
That's interesting.
I've been exploring that. What I did with my last series, I submitted it to... every once in a while, Houston has a cheap date art show, and that's typically a group show where every piece can't be more than $25. And the last series I submitted was for one of those, and I was exploring vulnerable women, but the way that I was sort of drawing them was with a lot of just really nausea-inducing color combinations, where just the patterns I used were all just swirls with all of these different colors, where you see the image and you want to keep looking at it, because whether you're a man or a woman, you've been trained to just stare at women that are exposed. But the longer you look, the more sick you feel, because you're focusing on all of this chaos that's all of these different colors. That was an interesting thing for me to try, and I think that I'm kind of still on that kick. So next time I draw for myself, that's probably what I'm going to work on.
Tell me a little bit more about your artist's name.
Beloved. I spell it a little unconventionally so that it's easier to find. B-L-U-V-V-D. And I started doing a ton of artwork in Houston, I'd say about 6 or 7 years ago. I was going through a really bad breakup, and I was just having a really hard time shaking off the feelings of rejection I was feeling. So I started drawing all of these ghost creatures, and I printed a ton of them out on stickers. And at the time, I would just go put them up all over the place, in bathrooms, on electrical boxes. This one time I decked out an entire bus stop out near the University of St. Thomas in these ghosts. It was almost like a Louis Vuitton pattern of just these ghost creatures. I was just sort of haunting the city and trying to come to terms with the feeling of not being wanted by somebody. And
while leaving your mark at the same time, because it's like a pretty good...
Hey, if you think about the psychodynamics of what it would take for somebody to actually be a ghost and haunt people, there are a lot of parallels there.
I mean, if he's just like walking by and he's like, oh my God, like that's, I can tell her artwork. That is her.
Yeah. And so he knew it. So I guess to some extent I was trying to get this guy's attention, but that didn't last very long, because I was just exploring myself as I did it. And I realized that whatever that was way cooler than just crushing on some guy or whatever.
Really cool art out of it.
The name Beloved came out of that. Honestly, the conscious primary motivation of using a pseudonym is that most of the artists that were making a living off of it that I was meeting at the time, who were primarily dudes, they all do that. And so I just internalized that sort of culture and decided to do it too. I feel like maybe in a few years, maybe after a few years of therapy for me, I might come around.
It might come around and just use your... I mean, it might be if you were to get really famous to just write your name on it. I mean, I'd like to have a Valerie original.
Well, yeah. But once I switch to Valeria Pinchuk...
Yeah.
Then that's going to make my beloved phase all the more valuable.
That's true. If you think about it. Yeah. So then, okay, that's an interesting point that you just hit on. So how do you, we talked earlier about being a female artist, but what is it like being an artist in general right now and monetizing those skills? Because talking to my dad was actually studying to be an architect when he was in El Salvador because he loved to draw and he loved making buildings and he was 17 when he left, and some of the stuff in his sketchbook is just out of this world. But, you know, he drew most of it just with like pencil and stuff. He was like, I really always wanted, to be able to afford like a real art set, but he was never able to afford it. Mm-hmm. So what is that like now as an artist? Like, how much do you invest?
Well, it's, I would argue that with the advance of technology, it's never been easier to be an artist. You have all of the resources necessary to monetize whatever skills you have, because all you have to do is find the appropriate website on the internet where you put your talents out there, and people are going to have projects that you apply to, and they're going to be willing to pay you. I feel like more than ever, visual artists definitely need to have at least a really rudimentary understanding of how Photoshop works or a similar program so that they can learn to digitize their stuff. But it's gotten to the point where as a concert artist, like for posters and stuff, when I make a poster, my ideal is that I draw something and then copies are made of it and then everybody sees it and they appreciate the artwork and some people take it home to put up on their walls. But realistically, that's happening less and less. Nowadays, people want their Facebook banner for the event page or whatever. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of a bummer for me because I love the way my stuff looks in person. But it's also a really great way to make money off of my art because nowadays everybody's maintaining their own brand. Everybody's got events. Everybody needs graphics for those events.
Sure. And the opportunities are endless, I feel like. Yeah. And you have more. You can fuse more together. You can make more, too.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, that really dilutes the concept of, you know, is it really art?
So tell me, what inspires you the most? It could be a book, a record, a song, a poem. What inspires you the most as an artist right now? Because I know that these things change and they tend to shift. But what is inspiring you right this moment?
All right. So I'm very glad you asked because I am currently going through... I've been going through this for about 15 years, but I am just in love with a Japanese director called Hayao Miyazaki.
Spirited Away.
Yeah, he did Spirited Away.
Yeah.
He did Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah.
I feel like he's best known for My Neighbor Totoro.
Yes.
And I'm familiar with all of these films. They're just so good. Gorgeous. They're so good. Every time I watch them, I don't ever like watching things again on my own, but I love sharing the things that inspire me with friends. And so I've seen every single one of these movies at least 5 times, mm-hmm. if not more, just sharing them with people. And one of my favorite interviews with that director, he's talking about the fact that a lot of his movies have really strong female protagonists.
Yeah.
And he makes this comment on it in an interview where he says, you know, I really love to make movies and stories around just really empowered female characters. And one of the reasons that I choose them is because I want girls to know that, sure, you might want your friends along the way, and you might need a little help from the people around you, but I want women to get the message that you don't ever need a savior. And just the art and the beauty of his films, which is enough to make me cry. I like to drink wine and cry, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm watching
that same
animations
mood.
And stuff.
Yeah.
I recently watched a documentary that I encourage everybody that's a Miyazaki fan to watch. It's on Netflix, and it's called The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness. Mm-hmm. And somebody goes into his studio during the time that he made his very final film, which was called The Wind Rises. He has since retired. It was his last film. Everybody knew that it was likely to be his last film. And you get to see that this person isn't just a brand. He actually is the way that his movies feel. And that isn't the reality that he lives in terms of magical stuff, but it is what he would like to see, and it comes across. And it's just so inspiring to me to know that this person exists and he's out there and he did what he did. It really, I want to be like him. And I would encourage everybody that ever feels jealous in their art or they feel threatened by other people that participate in their art and their community, instead of comparing yourself to the people around you, I would just wipe the slate clean and put the people on the slate that are the most successful and the most inspiring and compare yourself to them and see how you size up to them, because you're never going to make anything that's as good as a Miyazaki film if you don't consider yourself an equal.
Actually, Spirited Away is actually one of my favorite films. I watch that film every Friday after school for 3 years. Like, that is how much, like, Chihiro, that was my gal. She was the best. I remember, like, the first, like, year of watching it, I was like, this girl, like, she gets, like, all riled up for nothing. And then I remember she's a child. And then she becomes, like, she gets, you know, she gets taken away from her parents. She enters this ghost world. It's beautiful how this child overcomes, like, all these obstacles to get back to her family. And she does it by herself.
Well, most kids would.
Yeah.
And Miyazaki talks about that in this documentary about him. He says, I love children. I don't love a specific child. It's not about that. I just love all children. And the standard that he holds himself to is there are animations that he's made before that he isn't necessarily ashamed, but he regrets making them. There's one called Porco Rosso that he mentions in this documentary. And he says, I regret making this because this was the only film that I made that wasn't for children. And when he says that, if you really understand his work, you understand it isn't about like some superficial PBS quality where it's dumbed down or there are no sad endings or anything like that. What he means is his films appeal to the child in everybody. And yeah, it's like when you when you're 4 years old and you turn five, it's not like you stop being four. That person is still inside of you. And when you turn 34, you're not stopping being four. That four-year-old child is still inside of you, and your job as an adult is to integrate all of the experience that you had and to not be dismissive of anything because you were stupid or ignorant or whatever. Because, yeah, when you look at children, they're super brave and they're super mindful and they're super aware of their surroundings. And those are all qualities that I hope to retain in myself no matter how old I get, personally.
They have a very interesting perspective, too, creatively.
Yeah, that's because they're not anchored down by human socialization yet.
Yeah.
Where you're constantly having to worry about what other people are going to think about you.
Yeah. When you think about it, I came across a drawing that I made when I was a kid. And this was me when I was like, I would like to be an artist. And, like, just liked the idea of being an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, like, me and Selena. And, yes. Like, her last outfit that she wore.
The
her
purple
iconic,
sparkly one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was like, and then, like, me and, like, a little mini one. And so I was just like, this, you know, in my childlike mind, that was possible. Like, that was, in my mind, what I was dreaming of. And it's like, as an adult, I'm not going to sit here and draw myself with Selena. I might draw myself with Beyonce.
Hmm.
Because I think
should try drawing yourself with Selena and Beyonce.
And Pinocchi.
Mm-hmm. You can all be holding him in the pizza toss.
The pizza
formation.
Toss. Yeah. And then we can all be doing formation. But thank you so much for sharing your artist perspective. Is there anything else that you want to share before we...
No, I think I covered everything that I hope to.
So where can people find you? You have an Instagram.
Yes. I've got an Instagram. It's Beloved, spelled B-L-U-V-V-D. I'd say that's probably the best place to find me for now, if you want to follow my art. And
Do you take commissions?
And I work on a really flexible pricing scale, mm-hmm. where I'm usually pretty open to doing free artwork for causes that I believe in. And I can adjust what I charge based on where people are at. I just like having reasons to draw, and I love my community. I love Houston, and I can't wait to see what this next year is going to bring here.
One more question. What does Houston have to offer you as an artist?
Well, I mean, I've been all over the place. I've been to Israel. I've been all over Eastern Europe. I've been to Central Europe. And I've been in quite a few cities in the U.S., coast to coast. But Houston's the only place that feels like home. And what makes it feel like home is that people here, not everybody, but generally it feels warm and welcoming. And people here are really curious about what you have to offer. And in terms of my art, I couldn't imagine a better place to live. Just because of that. It's one thing to make art for myself, but I love sharing my art with other people. And I guess that's why I moved back here, and that's why I choose to live here.
Thank you for being a part of the very first episode of The Gallery, which is a curation of Houston artists. So I hope to have many more artists come on the show and talk about what they do and what they feel passionate about. Everybody can hit me up on my website, thegallerypodcast.com. You can also find me on Instagram at thegallerypodcast. Thanks, everybody.